this episode of the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. In this episode, Susan Smetzer Anderson sits down with author Mitali Perkins, an Indian American author of literature for children and young adults. They discuss how we might integrate ideas of shalom, beauty, and service, honestly and avoiding propaganda, in our artistic work individually and communally. And how can we sustain our own artistic pursuits in the face of challenges, internal and external, in the greater market and chaotic world? We hope you enjoy this episode of the Upwards Podcast.
Today I'm talking with author Mitali Perkins about art making and justice. She has written a new book called Just Making, a guide for compassionate creatives. She has written a book that speaks directly to my heart as a writer, and it has been reassuring to me to read it and to have her deal very authentically with the types of questions that I sometimes try to sweep under the rug of my life. So what Mitali has to share with us today is very relevant, whether you are a painter, a needleworker, or a writer, or an art maker of any kind. And I just want to welcome you today, Mitali, because you have written something that is very unique and I think needed. And I hope that people listening to us will feel like they're sitting with a friend who can understand what it's like to be a creative in a very unsettled world.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Susan, for having me. I loved my time at Upper House with you in person. And that is my hope, too, that at the end of the conversation, everyone tuning in will feel like a circle of friends.
Yeah, I think so. And you actually address that in your book. So your book is actually a three-part reflection. There's a little bit of memoir in it that is looking at what it means to be a creative and at the same time to be very concerned about justice in our world. And you also talk about why we sometimes get derailed from being makers and creators. Why do we stop making and creating art? And then you have this really interesting section about what it might take for us to keep making art. What kind of practices might we adopt to sustain our long-term work in the arts? So what I'd like to do first, though, before we get into any of that, is to give people a sense of who you are. And so what do you want people to know about you? What do you want them to appreciate about your background?
Well, let's see. I'm the third daughter in a family of Bengali immigrants. I was born in Kolkata, India. I have two older sisters, Sonali, which means golden, and Rupali, which means silver. And Mitali is me. I'm the third. And my name is more precious than silver or gold because it means friendship. So my name is friendship. And I think there's something about a name, right? It's always been my hope to be a friend. I always seek friends. And I think one of the things that when we arrived to the United States, my parents were refugees during the war of partition. And then we started as immigrants here without much money and in a small apartment in New York. My father had a good brain and my mom too, but they lost everything in the war. So they started from scratch here. It was the old American dream. And, but I remember the three of us, I was a very quiet little girl and often overlooked. So I guess if I were to introduce myself, I would say, I really like to see people. That is my, I think when I was first seen by God and loved by God, it was overwhelming to me because for so much of my life, I felt on the margins of that main vision where people were looking. I was sort of hovering on the edges there. And but there's something about wonderful about growing up on the edges of other people's purview, and that is you really learn to see. And so I think that whole, I guess Mitali Perkins is somebody who likes to see other people and to see what you said before, truth, beauty, and goodness in both the heart and the works of other people. That's right. My goal, my aspiration.
And it seems like a lot of your books deal with people who are on a journey, right, of growth and trying to pay attention to what's going on around them and navigate a challenge, which You do beautifully in your books, but a lot of your characters are not necessarily people in the mainstream, right? They might be a character, a rickshaw girl, for example, or do you want to just like highlight a few of the characters that you've brought to life in your writing?
Yeah, well, we can start with Rickshaw Girl, the daughter of a rickshaw puller who has two daughters. And in Bangladesh, where she lives, girls don't pull rickshaws. Her father becomes ill, and the whole village is saying, well, if only you had a son, provide economically. And in a lot of places in Bangladesh, girls were undervalued, devalued, partly because they weren't part of the economic system. My grandmothers couldn't work outside of the home. My parents are originally from what is now Bangladesh. So I studied political science and public policy, and I really did want to look at these questions of injustice. And then myself being a third daughter and heard sometimes growing up, people from the village where my parents grew up saying to my dad, it's too bad you didn't have a son. And my father's answer was always, he'd raise his head up high and he'd say, a daughter is just as good as a son. And I got to actually have the father in that book write that very phrase in that book when he's standing up to the villagers and saying, you know, and sure enough, in the book, in the course of her journey of Naima, the girl's journey, she gets to show that she can be a source of strength for her family and a source of repair and courage and fortitude for the whole family. Mm-hmm. So that was very satisfying to write.
I bet. I can imagine. Yeah. It's almost like in my family, I have a younger brother and we're very different from each other. But I remember growing up thinking, why does my brother get to mow the lawn and I have to do these other things? And it's just like there are these assumptions made about roles when we were children that to me really weren't obvious. Like, why are these assumptions made about gender roles? So in your work, you kind of tease some of those issues out in subtle and generous ways, I think, people can enjoy the negotiation that your characters are doing. So,
I do love that subtlety and that nuance around justice issues, because it's not necessarily there's a good guy and a bad guy, or there's some easy answer to fix what is an injustice. And there's often a nuance of a choice. In the book that's coming out this fall, upper elementary readers, a mystery set in the tea estates of Darjeeling up in the northern Himalayas. And it's about the Nepali girl whose mother's plucking tea, and her brother is falsely accused of a crime, and a golden necklace goes missing. And so she really wants to exonerate her brother to make sure he's not charged with that crime. So she goes on a quest to find the necklace. Mm-hmm. And in the course of that story, though, as I was writing the action part, the subtext is she has to question, how can she trust her brother? Like, can she really lean in to trust her brother? So there's that nuance of not just putting your blind faith into someone, but working out how she can actually continue to lean into trust, why leaning into trust for her is a better way to love than to suspect or to, you know, go into a turmoil of worry. So she makes these constant decisions as she's trying to solve the mystery to lean into that trust of her brother. And so there's always that subtext for me in my stories that exploring virtue and what virtue looks like. It's very nuanced, right? There's no easy, there's no textbook guide to how to be virtuous in all of these difficult justice situations.
I'm really glad you brought that back, because to the idea of justice and virtue, because you are contending with how do we contribute to justice in our society conscientiously as writers, as makers. And I wonder, you know, what made you decide that that's what you needed to write about? What led you to write this particular book at this time?
Well, I guess my only claim is that I'm still writing. I think in the book I describe, I've never had a breakout New York Times bestseller or some sort of a huge award. I mean, I will be forever grateful for everything that has been given to me in my career, but it's never been like, it's sort of up the back of the mountain in a circuitous route. And I just kept trudging along because I've really believed this is the way that I'm supposed to contribute to the planet. I had developed a heart for justice. As I said, I studied political science and public policy. And that did not stem from anything my parents taught us. They're wonderful people. But when you're refugees with barely anything, you're not necessarily talking about the philanthropic life to your children. You don't even have a bandwidth to provide bread to rice on the table for your kids. So when I was in college, I was realizing that my heart was gravitating toward a career for justice. And the only source for that, that I can know where that came from, is from the children's books that I read growing up. And I read and reread and reread. I was a voracious, feral reader. We moved to New York when I was 7, and I got let loose in the public library, and no adult said, read this, read that. I just found my way to books that I loved, and I keep rereading those to this day. So those books, like A Little Princess or Little Women or The Lord of the Rings, or they really shaped my heart for what is true north in beauty, truth, and goodness. And not that I accomplished that, but I knew what to aspire to. And so then I was in college. I wanted a career to fight injustice. I wanted to make sure there was not a hungry child in the world when I left the earth. And that was not a career that was at all encouraged in our home. I joke that there are three career options for Indian immigrants. Like, there's engineers, doctors, and engineers. That's basically, I said that when I was at Upper House last time. But I, you know, to say, hey, I'm going to have a career in the arts is not my parents' dream come true, right? So there was pushback on all fronts, and yet I persevered in this career. And so I think that's the reason why I feel like I have maybe the desire at this stage in my life to offer some words of encouragement to younger artists who are trying to persevere, because I faced a lot of odds, and even maybe more odds than somebody whose family supported a career in the arts, somebody whose parents were artists also, or there's other things that I had to face being a woman who's had no connections, an immigrant woman. I had no connections in any of the industries or the markets. I didn't know anything about book publishing. So I think that,
I was laughing with you as you said that, because one of the things you're describing is something I resonate with, which was my dad was a teacher when I was very young and realized he didn't feel like he can make a living doing it. He was a musician, a music teacher. And then he decided he'd become an engineer. And he made a very good living as an engineer. And then when I decided a long time ago that I really wanted to be a writer, he was like very concerned. And he said, so what are you going to do? Teach? And it was like the whole inflection on teaching. It's like, we're kind of told that certain things are less likely to lead us into success as success is described. But I think you unpack the whole art making endeavor in a way that accounts for the fact that you may not make a lot of money doing this, but you could still touch lives doing it. You could still make a difference doing it.
It can be one vocation among many. I mean, for me, it's my primary career. It's a career and a vocation. But I'm trying to, but for people who have careers and then are art making as vocation, it's still an important vocation. It's not like we have to have one thing. Our career is not our only vocation. As we were talking about, being a daughter is a vocation and being a mother is a vocation. So many different things we're called to.
Yeah. Would you tease that out a little bit more, the difference between a vocation and a career? Because I don't think we talk as much about vocation in this world as we do in the United States anyway, as we do careers. So,
Right. Well, you know, careers are the things we make money in, right? And they're valued by the wider society as our contribution to the planet. But that's sometimes true of vocation as well. A vocation can be honored by the wider society. People will pay money for your contribution, but sometimes sometimes I think it's related to anything that we have to put our hand to the plow to work at, to make this world a more beautiful, good, and true place. And it's a sense of calling, like parenting or being a spouse or serving the church or, but creativity, also making beautiful things, is another vocation. And it's a stirring in our hearts. It's a way we're designed. You know, that quote by Friedrich Buchner, that the world's deepest need meets our, our truest bliss or something like that?
Something like that.
Where we get in that, I talk about this in my book, the idea of flow, where you're flowing in your work. Of course, it's hard work and you're doing it, but you can feel the sense of almost being escaping chronological time when you do it because it is something you're designed to do. And yeah, the world will not give you, especially when it comes to children, the world will never pay you for any work related to children because children are so devalued in our culture, but in the wider world as well. But it's something that deeply meaningful work in God's kingdom. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that, I mean, blessed are we if our careers and our vocations converge, right?
Right.
But right. I think we'll have more than one vocation in the course of our life, and simultaneously we'll hold different vocations at the same time.
What I want to think about with you, Mitali, is you draw on a lot of fascinating ideas at the intersection of justice and creativity, as well as artist and receiver, mm-hmm. like the art creator and the person or people who would receive that art and community. So while you wrote this guide for creatives, you were drawing on your Christian belief system, but the book is clearly meant that to be read by anybody with any belief system. It's not limited to a Christian worldview. But you touch on the idea of shalom, which is part of the Abrahamic tradition. And I wonder if you could tease out a little bit how shalom is connected to vocation and justice and who we are as people.
Well, I guess shalom is sort of justice, little, you know, that exponential numerical. Mm-hmm. On top of it, because justice is making things right and making things fair, but shalom goes a step further, almost exponentially. It's about flourishing. It's about a fruitful life. It's about So I would like somebody to have food and clothing, but I would like to empower, say, a younger woman to have a fruitful, flourishing life where she's living that life where she can be a conduit of blessing to many and bring wholeness mm-hmm. and healing and truth and beauty and goodness to many, to the wider planet. That's the end result of being in a just life. And I guess it's a privilege to live with any kind of justice, right? Because that kind of flourishing and shalom is a deep privilege, and always for the sake of others as well as ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the kind of thing I'm hoping for, is that we would get a sense of our art as contributing to shalom for ourselves mm-hmm. as we make, and the flourishing mm-hmm. of ourselves. And I break that down, and yeah. how art, making art, creativity benefits us, mm-hmm. and then how it benefits the receiver of our art, the direct, that one-on-one. Here is a story I wrote, Susan, you read it, and hopefully the benefit would have in your life. But then also the idea of how it benefits the wider community to bring out that communal flourishing, because it's never just an individual story for us. Mm-hmm. So those are the three. I guess there are three parts of this choreography of art, three partners, the giver, the receiver, and the wider community. And it's such a give and take on both. Mm-hmm. And they're encircling the work. The work is also part of it. The work is a mysterious partner in it as well that has a life of its own. Yeah. And that is, you know, when we create, we are co-working with an unseen creative being. And so therefore the art itself really isn't fully of ourselves, right? It's always mm-hmm. woven together in partnership with the unseen creator. And so anything creative like that, whether we believe in him or not, a mm-hmm. creative work is going to include the great creator of all. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it's mysterious how the work has to be honored as well. And it has to be set free. It has to be liberated. It has to have a life of its own. It has to be protected from becoming captive to our own agendas, then it belongs too much to the giver, right? If the giver's saying, I will have this message, mm-hmm. and the receiver feels overpowered, but it won't have the impact. It'll become propaganda. Right. Or I want to make someone feel something. And so then gets over sentimental in the hands of a controlling creative. And then it becomes kitsch, right? Mm-hmm. So our art can become propaganda or kitsch if we don't liberate it. And that's one of the practices I talk about in the book, is our duty to liberate the work and not to be fearful that a message will not come through in it mm-hmm. or a feeling won't be evoked by it, mm-hmm. but to liberate the work itself. Yeah.
Right. I think that's a little scary in a way, because if you're liberating the work, you're also kind of humbling yourself to serve it in a different way, right? Than to like wrangle it into some sort of form that you think is absolutely the way you want reality to look. I mean, I'm saying this because I was raised to be a happy person, you know, and you want the happy ending. And sometimes the happy ending isn't the true ending. And the work, as you're writing it or as you're painting it, or I have a friend who's a printmaker. Sometimes it goes in a completely different direction. And mm-hmm. you realize, oh, well, that's the true way it's supposed to go. But it wasn't necessarily what I wanted. So I wanted to return again to the idea of shalom in terms of the way Cornelius Plantinga, the philosopher, defined it. And you wrote this in your book, and it was so helpful to me. It was universal flourishing, wholeness, and delight, a rich state of affairs in which natural needs are satisfied and natural gifts fruitfully employed. Shalom, in other words, is the way things ought to be. And I think what I want to draw from our previous conversation about this is that we may think things are supposed to be a certain way based on where we stand in the culture, but when we think more broadly in terms of the kingdom of God type of ideas, things might look completely different. They might be blown wide open. And that's where you talk about liberating the art. So I just was so blessed by that definition that you offered and Plantinga offered, because it reminds me that what I'm trying to do in the bigger scheme of things is part of a work that is happening, not just in my solo bedroom where I'm writing on a computer, but it's where a lot of people having the same heart and the same mind to do good things for the rest of the world. We're all trying to contribute to that universal. And it's not just about, sometimes I think we get so isolated in our art. We get so like focused on our one little project and we think this is never going to make any difference. But we aren't isolated. Not in the bigger scheme of things, when we're part of a community of believers in Christ. So I drew encouragement from that. And you have a lot of people that you draw on in this book that come from diverse Christian perspectives, and even saints from, what was it, Saint Anthony? Or which saint was it that you cite in one of your places, as well as just, I'm rambling here, so let me stop.
Yeah, I think I did go into a historical understanding back in the origins of the contribution of the church. And I do the examine practice from Saint Ignatius.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that is something that has really become deeply meaningful to me as a creative. And also in unearthing some of the inner threads, because what Saint Ignatius would encourage us to do is look at some of those threads inside our hearts that mm-hmm. prevent us from that kind of shalom. Mm-hmm. And so there might be, as I was saying, there might be a vice of gluttony, which is encouraging us not to look at a particular pain or to turn away from pain and seek solace in things like, you know, scrolling mindlessly or some of the things I do when I'm feeling, I don't want to feel what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. But in order to serve the art and to serve the wider community and to serve the receiver, I gave an example of, I was in Grand Rapids. I think right before I saw you guys, I was in Grand Rapids, and there's that, the beautiful Meyer Gardens. And I was wandering around, and actually it was quite a difficult time in my life. I was really struggling with some hard things, and especially the issue of shame. Hmm. And so I was wandering the gardens, and there was this huge statue of Eve, sculpted by Rodin. And I walked up to it. It's just this big, beautiful avenue that leads up to her. And I almost couldn't look at her because she's teetering off balance. She's so exposed. Her entire body is exposed to the public eye. She's trying desperately to hide herself and she's almost falling over. And it was so painful to look at her when I was experiencing my own issues with shame. But I made myself stop and contemplate it and take it in. And as I took it in, I started to sense that what you just talked about, that camaraderie of suffering, that idea of her bearing it and enduring it and being seen, like I talk about in one of the practices, is that idea of the contemplative gaze at art, right? Mm-hmm. When the receiver is able to gaze at art, it can offer solace. That's what happened to me that day in the gardens. I felt a sense of that commonality of human beings in our shame, that I wasn't alone in my shame. But going back to our first mother, right, she too grappled with feeling exposed and mm-hmm. feeling off balance. And mm-hmm. and so that it brought me, as I stayed there and contemplated, it brought me such solace. And I thought, mm-hmm. What if Rodin had pulled back? What if he hadn't delved into that whole expression of shame in that statue? So I was grateful for that.
That's great.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
Part of what you wrote there too was about when we're able to see that and grasp it, we can also look at other people perhaps more compassionately. Mm. That what we appreciate through awe and even through empathy, we open ourselves up to that. And then we're also more open to seeing other people with compassionate and generous eyes. And that gives us kind of the idea that if we're all made in the image of God, then when we look at other people, we may be able to be more able to see that image in them and serve them likewise, whether or not it's through our art. So I love the idea of thinking about that image of God as being part of our work. It's like exploring or allowing ourselves to think about who is it that we're serving, and then how does that God view the people in our world, and how might we serve them and or share our art with them? So you have some really interesting practices about, not practices so much as you talk about what it inhibits us from sharing our work. And I just want to touch on it briefly. You know, clearly it's very competitive to market our work. And it's not just the exterior forces of the competitiveness of the market and the narrowness, quite honestly, of the publishing market, but also there's things inside of us that keep us, that inhibit us from sharing our work. And what I love is that you go past that in this book and you start unpacking what it means to share our work in different venues, you know, through third places, and how we can indeed be creative in our agency for ourselves in sharing our work. And I just wonder if you can unpack that a little bit for our audience who would really indeed like to pursue their work, but feel inhibited because they feel like there's just not a way for them to easily get it out there.
Right. It's scary. It is scary. You're generating something from your heart, right? And if you are liberating it, there's a mysterious part of yourself that's woven into the art. And so then you're having to offer it up to people, and people who might say, no, thank you, I'm not interested in this. And that hurts. You know, there's a stigma.
It hurts.
Very painful. So what do we do then? Do we just cower in the corner with our art? And I think about Emily Dickinson and how she wrote all that poetry, but she never really accessed her audience ever. She died, and then afterwards we discovered her work and love it. So, and that's could be true for some of us, but for me it takes a certain amount of courage, because if we are to pursue that kind of just art that will bring shalom, it has to be received. It belongs to the receiver, as well, as flawed as it is. The art will always be flawed because we are flawed. Mm-hmm. Yes, we strive for excellent craft. Yes, we strive to create that next amazing, outstanding. We work with all our might, but we have our limitations and we're flawed. And so our art too will have limitations and flaws. And so we might be tempted to say it's not ready yet. And then there's some time for incubation to protect it. But at some point we need to gather our courage and say, here it is, here am I, here it is. And let it do what good it can bring into the world. And then it can still get, you know, I talk about the market like as a tent, and you're circling the tent and there's all these people out there and you just think, here's my work. And people are like, oh, thank you. And so I talk about third places, how that's an important place. And now, so when I started my career 30 some years ago, there wasn't as many third places. There's just now we have a very wide variety and abundance of places where we can, both online as well as in our local communities. And I make a case for local third places, embodied local third places. Yes, digital places are great. And I'm so glad we can, you know, upload our stuff to Etsy or whatever, and have it purviewed and have it received. Our stories, we can self-pub, we can do so many, we can reach people with our work. And that's beautiful digitally, but there is still that disembodied connection. There's something about a local sharing of our art, a reading aloud of it to a child on a lap, or in a library or a poetry mic, if it's the written word, or approaching a restaurant and saying, hey, I've bought several pieces of art in my home that I saw in local restaurants that have meaning to me because they're generated by local artists and by people I know. And so, and it's a beautiful way of looking at it, because it's not that we're going to get widespread fame and fortune or become celebrities or become the next great, Michelangelo or Beethoven, but we are going to create something that will bring joy to somebody else. And,
right.
A wider group of people. And that's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. I was thinking about my friends who create art and how much time they spend on it and how much skill they put into it and how little money they actually get for it in the mm-hmm. final analysis. And yet I look at it and I see something so rich and so deep. And so you also talk about just receiving, like if we do share or purchase artwork, who's actually receiving the benefit of that, right? Who's receiving the money for it and so mm-hmm. forth. So I think it would be wonderful if our churches, for example, purchase more of the artwork of mm-hmm. local people just as mm-hmm. a supporter of the arts. So
think about back in the day when the church did patronize the arts. There were guilds, and that was mostly like in the Florentine era. There are artists who generated work we still love, and it was supported by the church. Mm-hmm. And so you think about like a local artist in residence at a church, or let's say there's a young mom who, even just having that title on her in her resume, it may not pay much. It's space. Maybe there's gallery space for her, or a community of people that can say, "Wow, right. I love that." Do a showing, but she can be received that title. Like I'm the artist in residence at Madison. Whatever church, mm-hmm. there's just something that we need. And I have at our church, there's a place every one day a month, we have a Creative Commons where one of our pastors provides this charcuterie, and we have this space with music playing. We just bring our work and we work for 3 hours. And just in silence, I'm leading a retreat. You can find it on my website, July 31st to August 3rd in Cupertino, California, at a Catholic retreat center. And it's the same kind of thing. We just, any kind of writing, we come together and we celebrate the making and the receiving of art together in a very free and encouraging space. So I think the church is starting to get that idea, that sense. That was a little nudge I was hoping to give through the book.
Yeah. And I know our church held a poetry reading this past year, and I participated, and it was like the first time I ever read my poetry in public. And I was like, oh my gosh, this was so fun. I had such a great time, and there were just a few people there, but it was like, I finally did it.
So proud of you. That took a lot of courage.
Yeah, took a little plunge.
What a step forward for you and your work. I'm happy that you did that.
Thank you. What ancient practices have you learned and are wanting to share with people to help sustain them in their own art practice?
Well, there's two that I'll bring up. And one is the idea of fasting. I think fasting for me is a practice I love, but I'm thinking about fasting from consumption of other people's content, taking a day of the week where I appreciate the, I'm not a social media stinks kind of person. I think there's incredible creativity on social media, and some of it is funny and it's life-giving, and it's usually younger women that are creating it. And that may be one of the reasons why we look down on Instagram influencers, because anything generated by young women tends to be scoffed at, right? But some of it's really good content, and I appreciate it. But I think that to generate art, we have to guard our creativity by periodic fasts from stillness and silence. And I like to fill that time to pursue that thing you're talking about before, the contemplative loving gaze in other media. So like, for example, I am on social media and I do use words. So I take a break from words and I'll sometimes go to an art museum or a visual art or listen to music. And the other day when I was doing some speaking in Boston, so I went to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and in Boston, and it was chock full of tourists. So I thought, I don't really want to overhear a lot of words. So I put my earplugs in, and somehow Luciano Pavarotti seemed like the appropriate companion to this great Italian collection she had. So put my earbuds in. I had that great opera playing. It's not my tradition. I don't really, but it just fit it. And I just left with such a sense of refreshment. And it was a day to fast my own words from the words of other people, because I'm a word person. Mm-hmm. And just in other kinds of beauty. Sometimes it means walking in nature. And but it's a different way to fast than maybe just filling the time with something other than your media in a beauty and practicing contemplative gaze. So that's one. And the other practice I would say is the harder one is I talk about embracing what I call moments of mortification. Wow. And that's a tough one, because if you're going to try to have a long walk of obedience in the artistic life, there are going to be moments where you feel like you want to run for the hills. I don't know if you felt that walking up to the mic that day in a poetry reading, but there's just a sense where your cheeks burn and you think, why am I exposing myself? Why am I doing this? This is hard, right?
Right.
Or when you get a big fat no, or when you get a... So I feel like in order to persevere, we not only... And there's an ancient practice I describe of, it's like a four-step practice where one of the church fathers described what to do, how to turn a moment of mortification into something that builds our perseverance and strengthens our vocation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we do is we stay in that moment. We don't flee. Mm-hmm. And we ask for a way. It's usually a bodily thing we can do that will liberate us from the captivity of what other people think or how other people feel about our art. It's pretty powerful. I've experienced this several times, many times in my own vocation. I'll just give your listeners one example. So there's this, I don't know if you've, have you had a book come out that you've had to go to a signing, Susan?
Not yet.
Okay, well, wait.
I'm planning on it happening one day.
And then you get so excited. You have a book out. Oh my goodness. And it's got an ISBN number and it's available on booksellers and you're excited. Yeah. And then you say, I'll do a book signing. And so you go to a book signing. And one of my first one was my second novel, which had been rejected by 22 different publishers. Yeah. And took 12 years between my first novel and my second novel. Finally, it came out. And I got invited to this big convention. I was going to do a signing. And I thought, wow, this is. And I went to a signing and I was sitting between, and it was a children's book conference. So the author Mo Willems, who wrote...
Oh, my goodness, really?
Yeah. And then the author John Green, who wrote, all the other young adult novels. And my table was in between those two luminaries. And also, happened to be handsome men, which is, in the library world, is also another problem. Anyway, their lines came in and their lines were just chock full of, and there was not one person in my line. Not a person.
So horrifying.
Yeah, you're publicly, everyone can see that, And so I'm sitting there and I remember thinking, I should just get out of here. Mm-hmm. But I was a mom of younger kids at the time. And I thought, listen, I've got 25 minutes left in this moment. And I have a book I'm working on in my bag. I could just use this time. So I pulled my work out and I put it in front of me. And I began to work on the manuscript. And the great thing about encountering your art is you get into that flow and you forget about everything. So the first gift was, I forgot where I was. I was just like, oh, I'm into my work. And then another amazing gift happened to me. It was early in my career. And I think God knew I needed something big to help me embrace further moments of mortification. But I looked up and there's a beautiful redheaded woman there and she's standing in front of me and she said, she left the line. I think she left John Green's line. And she came over and she said, oh, you're Metalli Perkins. You wrote this book called Monsoon Summer. That was my second novel. And she said, oh, I like that book. And what are you working on now? And so I said, it's the story of a rickshaw daughter of rickshaw puller. And I'm working on it. And that book at that point had been rejected by, I think, 14 different publishers.
Oh, my.
And so she says to me, oh, that actually sounds really interesting. I'm an editor at Charles Bridge. Would you send me that? And so I did, and Charles Bridge bought it, and it's been my best, one of my best-selling books, and it's, became a stage play, translated. Mm-hmm. It's just like she's been pulling a rickshaw along while I've been pedaling on my career. And I think about if I had left and not really just embraced my work at that moment, but caved into my mortification, I feel like it was a lesson that was underlined in that moment for me that sustained me in the future when I was going to face other moments where I needed to persevere. And there's always something bodily you can do. Pull out a manuscript, get that red pen out, turn to somebody else and strike up a conversation. It's something you do with your body that I think it was St. John of Climactus who gave us a four-step procedure to handle a moment of mortification. And he talks about a bodily act, that it's an act of a penitential act that will lead us forward through it to appearance. So mm-hmm. yeah, so embrace the moment of mortification, ask for help to stay, don't flee, and look for something you can do with your body that will free you from the captivity of worrying about, it'll like your cheeks will cool down and you'll feel a sense of being in your body again and being yourself again, and you'll recover your agency and your love for the work, which is what it's all about, right?
Right. I am so glad you went into deep depth about that, because I think that is what everybody is the most afraid of, is like being mortified in public and having people feel sorry for you or whatever. But the way you just discussed that is so empowering. Mm. So thank you. I really appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, I hope it's helpful to others. And I think, again, that's the only thing I can offer, is that I've survived, nay, I have embraced many, many moments of mortification and continue to do so. Because when you create something, you're pushing back against chaos. And chaos and evil do not like it. And so there's going to be a force that's going to tell you, do not make. What you're making is not good. And it's not going to do anything. And so there's going to be pushback, and you need to persevere. And I guess that's the thing I can offer the readers of Just Making, is I'm still here. I'm still making.
You are. And you are highly regarded as an author. I've heard that. And as a matter of fact, my husband was a bilingual resource teacher and ESL teacher, and he used your books in his classes. Yeah, and I was reflecting on that. I was reading this book because you mentioned how even if it's just one person, even if it's, you know, a few people, and you're not like hitting the bestsellers list, if you make a difference in helping that one person think about something or to feel seen, then that is success. And so anyway, my husband was very excited I got to talk to you.
Hello, thank you.
I will.
Is he a Spanish speaker?
He is a Spanish speaker. He's retired now, but
tell him gracias para todo el trabajo. Y gracias para servir las pequeñitas. There you go. That's my Spanish. So I said, thank you.
Whatever you just said, I'll tell him she said something really beautiful. I have no idea what it means. It's like, well, I'm sure many of our listeners know much more than I do of Spanish. But it has been such a joy to talk with you. And thank you so much for sharing about your book. There is so much in this book regarding practices and ways to think about your work that is unique and empowering. I just want to salute the work that you did on this, the thoughtfulness of sharing your perspective and even some of your humiliations and how you persevered. And we'll have the information about how you might find the book and the exact title in our notes. And is there anything else, Mitali, you want to share?
I think only that I'm such a fan of what you're doing at Upper House. I loved my visit there. I loved that convergence. It feels felt very much like home to me, because you're trying to find intersections between some of the things I love, the kingdom of God, God's people, the arts, students, and trying to encourage a whole generation of makers in the church. What you're doing is really patronizing artists, and in that old school way. And so keep on doing what you're doing. It's really an encouragement to me, and it makes me hopeful for the future of the way the church will serve this tired and hurting planet, is if there are places like that. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll share that with our colleagues too. So you have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses, so that all may flourish.